Welcome to Faithful Economy, a podcast of the Association of Christian Economists. We host conversations about important economic and moral questions. I'm your host, Steve McMullen of Hope College. In this episode, I interview my colleague from Hope College, Stephen Smith, about the place of China in the global economy. Stephen grew up in Hong Kong and has visited China numerous times in adulthood, often traveling with undergraduate students. He's a close observer of Chinese politics, economics, and culture. With all of the China-related news over the last year, it seemed like a great time to corner Stephen and get his perspective on a whole range of related questions. As a scholar, Stephen specializes in international trade, growth, and development. He's the author of a book on economic growth with Ed Noel. He's also a longtime leader in the Association of Christian Economists, currently serving as our vice president. I should also note that we recorded this interview right at the height of the COVID-19 restrictions. We opted to speak in person, but our masks and distance makes this recording quality just a little bit worse than other episodes. I doubt it will really impact your listening, though. Thank you so much for being with us, Stephen. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you. So much about China seems super important and really hard to understand from my perspective. So let me start out with what I think might be kind of the big question that needs to be addressed before we go anywhere else. According to IMF estimates, China's GDP is sitting around $27 or $28 trillion, compared to about $20 trillion for the United States, $11 trillion for India, $5 trillion for Japan, and then there's lots of other countries in that range, just a bit less wealthy than Japan. So China is easily, at this point, the biggest economy in the world. And it really dwarfs just about every other geopolitical player in the world other than the U.S. Can we talk about that a little bit? Is that good? Is it bad for the world? What makes you nervous and what makes you excited?
Thanks so much for having me today. It is such a treat to be able to talk about China. This is something I've been thinking about for a long time, as you know. It is amazing to be sitting here in 2020 with the realization dawning on Americans that China really is a big country, and it's a big economy, and it's not going away. And I think it's really helpful to keep this in mind. It means, I think, that we'd be having some issues with China, even if they were a democratically governed market economy.
Yes.
Because Gen Z is the students we're teaching right now in our classes. They're the first U.S. generation to grow up in more than 100 years in an economy that's not the world's largest. And I think in practical terms, that requires a real adjustment for not just for students, but for us. We've been accustomed so long to thinking about global problems as, well, what if the U.S. did this? What if the U.S. did that?
Yes.
We kind of reflexively think of the U.S. policy decision as being dispositive about a global problem. That's no longer right. It was so interesting in the Democratic presidential debates to see and hear candidates talking about global warming. And it wasn't until the final presidential debate, I think it was Biden, who mentioned that actually maybe we should talk with China about this too. Yeah, that's a good idea. Yes, indeed. Let's. But that's not just true for global warming. It's true for such things as what should be conditions on loans to sub-Saharan Africa. What should be, you know, the functioning of the WHO? Just to take a recent example. But there's no question that the emergence of China is, in one sense, just absolutely, basically, a good for the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's good because human prosperity is good. China is an ancient and accomplished culture. Its people deserve to flourish and be prosperous. It's a really good thing that China is now radically better educated and better off than before. You know, in its most rapid reform phase, coming out of the pure communist period that ended around 78-79, it was a terrific example of the benefits of market-oriented reforms for the rest of the world. And of course, its rapid growth and rapid emergence into middle-income status has meant that the past 50 years have been, China's experience combined with India's experience, the past 50 years have been a period in which, for the first time in about 500 years, global income distribution has been improving rather than worsening. And so, I mean, this is just all good. But I think the problem and the potential danger of China's rise is related to the fact that China is both big and poor.
Yes.
So, yeah, in per capita terms, it's Mexico.
And which isn't poor in global terms necessarily, but it's pretty middle income, right?
Yes, that's right. And in fact, it's upper middle income in the World Bank characterizations. But from the point of view of a typical Chinese person, they're still a relatively poor economy. They're proud of the accomplishments of the high-speed rail system and the skyscrapers in the major cities. You know, they're proud of the growing domestic auto industry and so on, but they still feel poor and somewhat vulnerable. Well, the rest of the world looks at them and thinks, oh my goodness, here's the steamroller.
Yeah.
Of course, now, you know, all of that is heightened by the emerging, in fact, long emerging ideological contest now between China's state-led system and its politics. The competition between us and them, and indeed really between the rest of the world and them. We can say more about that later, probably.
Well, let me push on that just for a second. So tell me, is there a necessary conflict? Like, is it possible to go 100 years with the U.S. doing its thing, let's say no major changes in kind of the way we do economics and politics, and then on China's side, they double down on their state-oriented, kind of state-centric, quasi-market model. Is that not sustainable? Are we at a disequilibrium that's bound to fall into some worse position, or what's going on here?
Yes, I would say unfortunately, this is not the case that the world experienced in the late 1800s and early 1900s when the old hegemon was replaced by the new hegemon. Certainly, there were tensions between Britain and the United States. But shared deep values and commitments to democracy and global openness. So China is simply not there. It is in the current manifestation, which really began to emerge clearly into focus when Xi Jinping became general secretary and took power in late 2012. It's really become apparent that the control of the Communist Party of China over virtually all aspects of Chinese economics, politics, and society has become the lodestar and the guiding principle in his policies. In fact, to the point where I might say that it's better to describe China now as a totalitarian statist system and not simply an authoritarian statist system. You know, a lot of people are in effect saying something like that without using the word totalitarian. I read an article recently by Elizabeth Economy. By the way, isn't that just the greatest name for somebody who's studied political economy?
Yeah, that's pretty wonderful.
I mean, how does that happen? That's so glorious. So she's writing in Foreign Affairs in 2019 in an article called China's Neo-Maoist Moment. And she says, Xi has revived the methods and symbols of Maoism, not in service of a return to the past, but in order to advance his own transformative agenda, one that seeks to ensure that all political, social, and economic activity within and increasingly outside of China serves the interests of the Chinese Communist Party. This is, and in its actual manifestation, the suppression of dissent, the abduction of CEOs from the streets, of foreign nations, the rejuvenation and tightening of the party's control over privately owned firms, over universities, over state-owned firms. All of that is pointing in a totalitarian direction. The social credit system, the internment of the Uyghurs in the West, and just that alone, it is hugely significant indicator of the nature of the regime. The instinctive desire to suppress any kind of dissent, which we saw on clear display in the COVID, in the early days of the COVID crisis, where the poor young Chinese doctor was jailed for 2 days for making accurate posts online about the medical situation in Wuhan. This is totalitarianism. This is a real problem for the Chinese people and for the world.
So that raises, you know, 1,000 more questions than the one I started out with, of course. But let's go down a couple of different veins with this. You mentioned only briefly with the global warming thing, the impact that China has on the environment. And I think for those of us who watch environmental policy, of course, this is a big one. We get stories. I mean, I have stories from friends who've lived in China, having lived with masks because they lived in one of the major cities for years because of the pollution. And so I have an impression, at least, that the pollution in major cities in China is just very, very bad, and maybe well beyond. Can you talk about the trajectory there? Clearly, they have a pollution problem that's far worse than what we're experiencing even in cities in the U.S. Are they on a good track? Are they improving? Is it getting worse as they grow? Should we be hopeful or despairing?
So that is a great question. And China being, you know, a continental-sized economy with provinces that have a significant amount of autonomy from the central government, actually kind of analogous to U.S. states. These are not simply administrative divisions of a country. They represent distinct language groups often and with distinct histories. So China is a complicated place. And so let me say, that does mean that China's totalitarianism also is more complicated and nuanced than we might, you know, than we might intuitively think, and I can come back to that. So you know, it's true. You have some Chinese cities where they were the first in the world to introduce natural gas fired city bus fleets and taxis. You know, and that's a wonderful accomplishment. Those kinds of things do contribute to an improvement in air quality, no question. But I think it's fair to say that overall, given its income level, the central government has, many of the provinces have been less responsive to people's desire for a cleaner environment than would have been the case in a democratically governed society at a comparable income level. They persisted in the use of coal for just a very long time. They remain the world's largest coal producer by a large factor. They use a lot of coal. The last time I looked, quite recently, although the share of coal in their electric generation has fallen steadily in recent years, it's still above 50%. And it's not, you know, it's not coal that's burned in plants that have scrubbers installed necessarily, all of them.
Right.
So the particulate emissions, along with the carbon emissions, are ferocious. So that's been a problem. And you know, I think I've not tested this. Part of me would like to run these tests, but I think they you know, if we were to draw China's environmental Kuznets curve, that on balance they'd be behind other countries at a similar level of development.
You would think if the kind of authoritarian, totalitarian approach had any benefits at all, it would be that they could take some environmental improvements on as a big capital project, which China has already shown they are more than willing to do, right? Not just the public transportation. So it is a little bit odd to me that they haven't placed this higher on their priority list. Is it the case that China is really really still aiming at economic growth, GDP production numbers as kind of their the main thing they're aiming for economically? I mean, what are they willing to sacrifice the environment for a 10% GDP growth rate?
I think it'd be fair to say that certainly the government has not, the central government has not acted as if they were willing to sacrifice GDP growth rates for environmental concerns until quite recently. The Chinese public, if you look at the World Values Survey, so Chinese public has been. Those surveys show that the public has been in favor of favoring the environment over growth for a number of years. But I could imagine a situation where as growth becomes more difficult for China, that I could imagine the system transitioning to one where the government was promising environmental cleanup, environmental remediation, an improved environmental condition. And then touting that as its you know, as its claim to fame and its claim for restoring China's greatness and its claim to continue to have the mandate of heaven to continue to rule.
That must be nice. let's switch over to an area where my default assumption would be that China's relation or China's growth would be a net positive for the U.S., and that is with trade. Because, of course, the U.S. and China have been trading very great volume for quite a long time. As long as I remember being literate, I remember trade with China being at the top of the economic agenda. Going back to most favored nation trade status when I started learning these terms in high school. But, of course, the last couple of years have been volatile. We've had a very serious trade war, which has been all over the news up until the point in which the coronavirus took over. And my assumption was that this trade war, just because I have a pro-trade kind of default, was that the trade war was misguided. But I say that with the caveat that I recognize that there were really serious intellectual property violations and lots of other ways in which China was not behaving well and something needed to be done. So talk to me about the state of trade between the U.S. and China a little bit. Is the trade war been helpful? Have we made progress? Has it largely been a problem for both economies as I would have anticipated? And really importantly, what do you think trade looks like going forward, both after the trade war is over? Maybe you need to look out 5 years till Trump's out of office, but also post-coronavirus, just to throw you a monkey wrench, right? What's the future of U.S.-China trade look like? There's 30 questions in one.
You know, I love that question, and I think one thing on which I may be a contrarian is I think the effects of COVID, once there's a vaccine, once there's a well-established treatment, better established treatment methods and prevention methods, I think the benefits of globalization and specialization and exchange are so compelling that they're going to reassert themselves. And I think with appropriate protocols about goods that are essential for national security and protocols about not trading in products made by prison labor and so on, I think we're going to see not a great disentanglement between the Chinese and U.S. economies. I think we're going to see a partial disentanglement between China and the U.S. economy. Supply chains moving into a number of other nations, particularly in Southeast Asia, but also some to India, some to Latin America, some to Mexico. And a recalibration of the global economy, but I would not predict a full scale retreat from globalization. In terms of
broadly though, sorry, I realize sure. I asked you so many questions. Is trade with China net beneficial for the U.S.? I mean, clearly U.S. policy over the last couple of years has seemed to think that on balance we were getting the raw end of the deal. Where does that fall in your estimate?
Net positive.
So I can continue with my default trade is good for us assumption.
Let me unpack that for you a bit. You know, long term, let's take a very long term view. There's really no reason why the U.S. trade relationship with China could not be something like the U.S. trade relationship with the EU. We're frenemies, but with more emphasis on the friend part than the enemies part. Sure. There's individual firms in some industries that are ineluctably in head-to-head competition with each other. Airbus and Boeing come to mind.
Yeah.
And it's very hard in trade agreements to handle such things as to account for such things as the subsidies that the Europeans give to agriculture, which exceed those for the U.S., or which they give to particular favored industries such as Airbus, which, in my judgment, exceed what Boeing gets. And so those kinds of competitions in trade will be perennial store spots. But by and large, the trade between Europe and the United States is hugely mutually beneficial. It's a lot of it is in differentiated manufactured goods, and there's tremendous scope for mutual gain in the product quality and the variety and the utilization of economies of scale that can be achieved in that kind of trade. Long term, that could be, and I think should be, our aspiration for trade with China. Now, a particular problem with China is its size and the genuinely significant mercantilist policies of the government. It was one thing when Japan practiced a kind of mercantilism more market-oriented mercantilism in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. They were an ally of ours. You know, there was a political trade-off involved. We wanted them to be strong. We wanted them to be prosperous. They were, you know, our bulwark in Asia as part of our defense around Soviet communism and of course, Chinese communism. China's bigger, so it's been much, much harder to digest its mercantilist policies. And those really have demanded a response. If there's any silver lining to the Trump trade policy, it is that it has galvanized the U.S. Foreign policy establishment and the business community to the real problems of a major global player that's not playing by market friendly or even in any real sense fair rules. It's might makes right. You know, for your continued presence in the country, we're demanding, you know, X share of the equity and so on. And no, we do want you to list this company's stock on the U.S. stock exchange. But no, we're not going to have its books accounted under generally agreed accounting principles. But yet, we have taken a blunderbuss to the situation. We've made a number of strategic errors in trying to remedy this. Instead of building partnerships with our natural allies in Southeast Asia and in the Western Pacific and in East Asia, we've gone about it solo, and we've targeted particular industries, steel and aluminum, which harm the tariffs on which harm U.S. manufacturing and harm our own economy, as well as most tariffs would do. It was an unforced error, a gift to Xi Jinping when, in his first day of office, Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. That was a very forward-looking trade agreement. It would have tied together much of the Pacific Rim and East Asia into U.S. standards for trade disputes, and tied us all to mutual goals of trade liberalization in services, which is incredibly helpful for us leaning into our comparative advantage of the next century, rather than looking backwards at things we used to have a comparative advantage in, such as steel. Mm-hmm. Very puzzling to me why even the Democrats ran away in the 2016 election, ran away from the TPP as well. Of course, suggesting that trade had such a bad odor at that point.
Yeah.
If you could bear with me for one more comment, the decline of U.S. manufacturing is complicated. It's something that had been going on for a very long time, decades prior to China's entry into the World Trade Organization. China has been a convenient whipping boy, I'm afraid to say, for some very deep problems in a number of U.S. States where we're really bearing the brunt of some of the problems associated with our bad design of our social safety net, problems relating to family composition, family structure, cultural changes, in other words, as much as economic changes. That I don't think has really been fully examined. It's been a very easy scapegoating of China to complain about the loss of U.S. manufacturing jobs.
Yeah, and there's, I think now we're maybe only in the last 5 years I've seen a much better, I think, emphasis on automation as driving a lot of that change. Maybe that'll balance things out.
And that's a big piece of it, right.
Well, but not that, of course, they're not both going on. These aren't in competition. But when you look at the data, of course, manufacturing output is still on its way up. And
you know, international trade theory teaches some hard truths, and one of them is that to the extent that you do have a trade problem with a particular country, ironically, that the best policy response is usually not a trade barrier. It's usually something much more targeted to the specific source of the problem. If China is stealing intellectual property, that you need a policy that directly relates to that.
Yeah.
You know, you rather than hitting them with steel tariffs, which hit us.
Yeah. Let's switch gears a little bit. I want to bring you back to one of the big themes that we started out with, and that is I want to think a little bit about about China's long transition from a kind of a pure communist state to one that is at least has over my lifetime been opening up a little bit more to some scrutiny of human rights and certainly opening up their economy. Now, the way I think about this is something like this. In my young, optimistic 20s, I thought China was headed toward democracy and relatively open markets, maybe something like a Western European country. And it doesn't look that way to me now, right? So I'm less optimistic today that there's a trajectory toward more economic and political freedom. So let me pose it to you. What does the next 50 years look like for political and economic freedom in China? And in particular, if you don't mind, I'd love it if you spoke a little bit to religious freedom as well, because that's an area of particular concern, certainly for a lot of folks in the church.
I absolutely want to speak to these issues. These are live, very much live issues. Oh my goodness. You know, it's very fashionable now to complain that the U.S. foreign policy elites and the State Department, you know, previous, you know, even the Reagan administration, never mind the Clinton administration, sold us out to the Chinese and had rose-colored glasses on and thought that, in ever thinking that China could in the course of its growth become more like us, and that it was a strategy of hope over any kind of experience. We've heard all those arguments. I think we need to think a little more realistically about that, believe it or not. I think it was not irrational to have hoped for better from China by now. The bet that with integration and prosperity, China would liberalize more and democratize more was not foolish. This has been the trajectory in a number of other countries in the region, and indeed in the early phase of Chinese reform and in the middle phases of it. So from the 80s through the first decade of the 21st century, democracy advocates emerged in various ways. Market advocates emerged. And at least in terms of economic liberalization, the regime seemed pointed towards further moves towards liberalization. I would accept very much that the U.S. approach was perhaps too credulous, not holding Chinese firms to the same disclosure standards as U.S. firms for listing on the New York Stock Exchange. That was a big mistake. And, you know, we can point to any number of those things. But the underlying reality is China is on a trajectory, whether it's slowly from here on out or rapidly from here on out, to continue to grow in wealth. And we were wise not to try to strangle that at its birth in 1979 or 1980. The world and certainly Chinese well-being was improved by the U.S. taking that kind of hopeful and engaged approach. Now, I think the verdict of history really is still out on that question. And an angle on this that I think is not sufficiently appreciated by Western observers is that China now is a wealthy middle-income country, is faced with a really stark choice. I think the kinds of reforms that it needs to undertake to grow to keep its growth rate at a reasonably fast rate going forward require economic liberalization and political liberalization. Mm-hmm. And those are precisely the things that the party is most afraid of. Economic liberalization that forced the restructuring and the shrinking of the state-owned firms, that would directly threaten the party's power and its control and a big chunk of its power base. Mm-hmm. The empowerment of the private sector, allowing it to get more credit from the state-owned banks. Again, that strikes at the party's ability to control patronage and build political support by requiring firms to be roped into its system. Right now, across all major firms, state-owned or privately owned or foreign-owned, there are party cadres at every level of the organization, both monitoring thought and teaching, with study groups in Xi Jinping thought for workers, and seats on the board of directors of major firms in order to have a say in what kind of investments get made and so on and so forth. this sets the stage for economic decisions to be made that in fact will not lead to much prosperity. China is in kind of the bind that Russia was in when nobody wanted to be the first to sit down and stop applauding during a speech by Stalin. If Xi Jinping thought is something you have to study and be loyal to, it's going to be hard for firms to make truly independent and arm's length decisions about appropriate next investments, appropriate trading partners, appropriate joint venture partners. Private firms might as well be state-owned at that point. China is at risk of losing a tremendous dynamism and squandering the value of its native entrepreneurial talent because the politics will tend to dominate. And, you know, I haven't even mentioned their demographic challenges.
Yeah, that's true. Now, quick, a question, because I just don't understand what it would be like to start a small business in China. What would be the prospects of getting financing from outside the state-influenced financial system? Let's say an entrepreneur in Beijing came to San Francisco and looked for venture capital. Could they escape some of the oversight from the government if they went looking for financing elsewhere?
You know, my understanding is that with permission, something like that would be possible. There's not...
Permission is a key word.
Yeah, with permission, right. Because China does... The capital account is not open in China. It's all by permission only.
Wow.
Your hypothetical entrepreneur would have needed to show appropriate loyalty to the party, willingness to join the party. Perhaps to become a member of the National People's Congress and speak in favor of the party publicly. And that's a challenge. That's a challenge. Now, there are private banks in China, so there might be some private domestic financing that could be arranged. And certainly, you know, from retained earnings, you might finance a wonderful run of growth for a while. But basically what happens is that as private firms emerge and grow, they get absorbed into the system. And their leaders face some hard choices.
That makes sense. You wouldn't be able to stay off the radar long.
Right.
Certainly, even if you did find, yeah, okay. Let's turn to Hong Kong real quick. I know Hong Kong is near and dear to your heart.
Oh, yes.
And of course, it's been all over the news. And a lot of us have gotten a little bit of a crash course, I think, in Hong Kong politics and history as we were trying to make sense of what has been going on. So tell me what your read of the politics in Hong Kong are right now, and whether or not, again, I want to know trajectory, right? Is there a chance for Hong Kong to remain or maintain some kind of Western standards of justice apart from mainland China, or is that a bit of a lost cause?
You know, it's feeling like a lost cause at this point, with the only benefit that this problem may have been navigated without the PLA literally coming into Hong Kong and fighting in the streets, which is clearly a good thing to avoid.
Yeah.
But the new security law, basically, which was passed by the National People's Congress and now about to be promulgated for Hong Kong, basically does what the extradition bill would have done, which the protests managed to stave off. And the Carrie Lum executive did not, you know, wasn't able to bring that through Hong Kong's normal legislative process at Beijing's request. But we're there now anyway, and worse, because the new security law gives Chinese security forces the right to operate in the region with virtually no oversight from Hong Kong government. So there we are. This is a momentous change in Hong Kong's situation, and Hong Kong's situation was changing anyway. The the growth of Shanghai and Shenzhen as high tech centers in Shenzhen's case, and a financial sector in Shanghai's case, those were definitely cutting into Hong Kong's comparative advantage and into some of Hong Kong's most lucrative businesses. Hong Kong was becoming more of a tourist destination as its main support, and I think that process will now be accelerated. And the options for those in Hong Kong and in the West who want to support Hong Kong as a free city under British inherited Western style civil law, the prospects are dimming for sure. I have to say though, and I think this is an important thing that some in the West aren't quite catching yet, The protests really do mark a very fundamental change in Hong Kong's culture, and a change that is likely to be at work in China as well long term, which is that after several generations of being content to keep one's head down and one's feet moving and making money, the current generation of students and young people in Hong Kong want something more. They like their freedoms. They are not being pushed to protest by outside agitators, as the state-owned and influenced press mendaciously maintains. These are groundswells of sentiment, authentic, original sentiment. Same kind of sentiment that led to the creation of democracy and the achievement of democracy in Taiwan. The Hong Kong that I knew as a child and an adolescent growing up is gone. And indeed, the Hong Kong of really even 20 years ago is gone. It's been replaced by an urbane, hopeful population that values its civil rights and while being authentically Chinese. And there was an article appeared in Quillette a few weeks ago. No, I guess it was late last year. It was written by a guy who's a professor at Lingnan University in Hong Kong, a liberal arts college in Hong Kong. And I'm going to get this quote almost exactly right, I think. But we can check it. We can check it later in Quillette.
That's fine, and we can of course link to the article in show notes.
Okay, great, excellent. The guy's a professor of sociology at Lingnan. His name is Bear. He's speaking with a young protester, college student, and she says this. This just blew me away. If you ask me, I will tell you, I am willing to die for Hong Kong. That's the new Hong Kong. This is powerful, and this is not going away anytime soon. So I think the verdict is still out here. A number of commentators in Hong Kong and elsewhere have been advising the Communist Party to prepare for the day when they could ease themselves out and prepare the ground for some kind of democratic transition, because on the ground, the people's hearts are ready for that.
That doesn't sound like a goal that the Communist Party would anticipate with any kind of great happiness at the moment.
Well,
certainly.
Well, you're right. This title of an article in Foreign Affairs by a professor at the University of Hong Kong though says it all. The guy's name is Ji Wei Zi. Without democracy, China will rise no farther. And he argues, and I kind of get this, that not just in Hong Kong, but maybe not even especially in Hong Kong, but in China, the growing middle class, which to China's great credit, really is better off than any other time in history, and radically better off with vacations and the ability to drive into the countryside for a picnic, to get good health care, to get a good education. These are wonderful things, and the middle class is growing and leaning into these things, and it's a wonderful thing to see. It's just wonderful. But this Xi's argument is that in practice, this means that people want there to be better treatment of women in China. They want there to be more scope for voices to be heard, this professor's recommendation is that the party would be wise to listen to that and begin to open up those avenues.
That makes a lot of sense. My basic working model for how the Chinese government would end up being forced into adopting a more democratic model has to do with a mix of prosperity on the part of their citizens, right, and growing economic connections, which of course this isn't my model. Of course, this is what I learned in undergraduate international relations a bit, and reading too much Thomas Friedman perhaps growing up. But my assumption always was that if you get enough young, ambitious, economically connected, moderately wealthy people in the population, they will just demand some kind of economic and political freedom. And of course, China has been, if nothing else, extraordinarily innovative at ways of at coming up with ways to squash those kinds of movements in their own population. But it seems like Hong Kong would obviously be ground zero for this kind of thing, with the caveat that they might not be big enough to start anything that would impact all of China. But I do appreciate a little bit your pessimism and optimism at the same time, that maybe democracy and economic freedom really are required for China to move forward. And so maybe without, you know, Lord willing, without any external conflict, maybe internally, the next 20 or 30 years will actually look a little bit brighter on those counts.
That's my earnest hope. I have to say, right now, many of the young people in China, as opposed to Hong Kong, have been content to live with the social credit system and the strictures on what they can say because of the palpable progress.
Yeah.
You know, it's common to hear them refer to, you know, the glories of being able to pay with a cell phone and WeChat and the high-speed rail. And there's a very legitimate national pride with that. But I think a looming sense that it's not enough. It won't be enough long term. So I hope you're right about that speculation.
You know, just to bring in a piece of data that I saw in a book I've been reading recently from Jonathan Rothwell, and I can link to the book as well. He makes the case that the population's support for their own government seems to be correlated with an interaction between two things, and it's inequality, but it's also growth. And that it's when you have a combination of inequality and stagnation that governments in particular face real problems. And so you could imagine that becoming the public relations nightmare for China, if indeed you're correct that they really don't have a lot of continued upward trajectory without increased liberalizations. You could imagine the young people in China no longer feeling like this is a good bargain. Of course, that's reading the tea leaves pretty far, but
right. So this is, you know, this is obviously just, you know, pure speculation. But I think that's a very fair point. It would be ameliorated somewhat by the fact that Nick Eberstadt predicts that by 2040, the share of young professionals, say people in their, you know, from their 20s until age 35 or 40. Their share of the workforce will have fallen by 75. There'll be 75 million fewer of them in China than previously.
Wow.
So
it's just not going to have the majority.
So you know that and of course as China's society basically gets older, that may soften demand for change.
Hey, I'm going to hit you with a question that I didn't prepare you for at all, and it warrants preparation. And then after this, I'll also give you a chance to for any final thoughts, if you have anything else that you think is worth talking about. But I've been meaning to ask this question of everybody that I interview for this podcast, and that's a real general question that I know you've thought about before. So let me pose this to you. What is the role of the Christian economist in particular? Does Christianity bring anything important to the practice of economics? And how do you even approach questions like that? It's a big one. Yeah,
that's a big one, and we're shifting gears radically. But
it's a huge radical shift.
You know, that's totally good. That's totally good.
It's within my vast powers as an interviewer.
You are right. You are certainly exercising that vast, almost dictatorial power. I would say
authoritarian.
Authoritarian. So you know, I think one of the wonderful things that Christianity can bring to the study of economics, I mean, that it equips Christian economists to be able to be, is humble about economics as a discipline. The economic model, homo economicus, utilitarian, utility theory, ethics in terms of, you know, assessing cost-benefit and making policy decisions, that is, from a Christian point of view, that cannot be the whole story about how to design the economic life or policy. Work is not just utility. Work, in a Christian point of view, work is what mankind is created for, but so is rest. You know, humanity has an inherent dignity, and economic systems have to honor that, which means you have to have a well-functioning social safety net, because life's vicissitudes affect different people differently. And, you know, you can't walk down the road that, you know, Ezekiel Emanuel has walked down and say, well, let's basically euthanize people at age 75 or you know, deny them health care after that.
Economic productivity is the only thing.
Right, exactly. And The utilitarian way of thinking is a useful way of modeling certain kinds of decisions. Does my family on the margin buy more food now, or do we buy a slightly bigger house or rent a slightly bigger house? It's marvelous for thinking about those kinds of trade-offs. But in terms of especially what it takes to raise children to be fully formed humans with empathy for others and a wide view of the common good and a willingness to listen and all those good things we'd want for children, that comes from love and dedication and a healthy family culture. And economics is just completely silent on all of that, although these are things that are fundamental to an actual healthy economy. So I think humility, just humility. I mean, economists, this day and age, because we're one of the few social sciences that has any kind of authority left, our quantitative abilities, I think, earn us that in current discourse. We get listened to, and I think it's appropriate that we're listened to, because I think we've got some genuinely good things to say about thinking about different things. But boy, we've got to be careful to not overstate our case.
You know, I've often thought myself that that being a Christian gives a scholar a whole window, not like having an advanced degree in the humanities for sure, but it gives us a whole language for thinking about a set of concerns outside of our discipline. I really appreciate the way you put that a Christian might maybe has a countervailing community and language that can remind us when we're reaching the edge of our methods, and that can be very helpful. Let me throw it back to you. How would you like to conclude? Is there anything that I should have asked you about China or about economics that I didn't ask, or some lingering thought or question or observation that you didn't get to in our conversation here?
You know, you're so kind to, and your listeners are so kind to have heard me out on all these things. I think there is actually one final thing I'd like to say, and it's both about China and about Christians. I find it helpful to remind myself from time to time that God loves the Chinese people absolutely as much as he loves me or you or anybody in America. Those people are the apple of his eye. And China, for all of its current struggles and issues, China can yet emerge as a prosperous and free society. The Chinese people deserve that. And the Christians in China deserve that. It was such a privilege, and it's been humbling to me as an adult to think, to have grown up, you know, in connection with the church in China, and to be able to continue to know people in the church in China in the struggles they faced. Oh my goodness! By some counts, there are more Chinese Christians than there are people in that Christians in the United States who attend church on any given Sunday. I mean, you know, there's a lot of Christians in China, and we should be praying for them. They are doing things that are doing good in China right now and capable of being true salt and light in a very difficult situation. They deserve our support.
I think that is an excellent place to end. Thank you so much, Stephen, for having this conversation for us. It really is a joy. I know I learned a lot, and I'm sure lots of others as well. I'll be sure to link in the notes along with this show to the articles that we mentioned. And of course, if listeners have questions, they can send them to me, mcmullen@hope.edu, and I can forward them to you, or they can dig out your email address and send them right to you. And thank you again for all the preparation and for the thinking. And it's kind of the whole lifetime of experience that's allowed you to be so thoughtful about this stuff. That's really hard sometimes for those of us in the West to make sense of.
Thank you so much.
That is our show for today. Again, I am Stephen McMullen of Hope College and editor of the journal Faith and Economics. If you have any comments or questions, I would love to hear from you. You can always email me at podcast@christianeconomist.org. Remember to subscribe or follow us so you can see new episodes as we release them, and to rate us on Apple Podcasts so that other people can find this show. For those interested in supporting the show, we welcome monetary donations. Just go to anchor.fm/faithfuleconomy and click on the button that says support. 100% of donations go toward the programming of the Association of Christian Economists. No one associated with ACE is paid a dime, and donations are all tax deductible. Faithful Economy is a program of the Association of Christian Economists and the journal Faith and Economics. You can find out more about the association and the journal at christianeconomists.org. and you can follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn.